Justice of the Court, opposing counsel, William Mason and Brian Diaz are two former police officers of the UNLV Police Department. Together between them, they have 56 years of combined police experience. In the summer of 2002, they were falsely accused of misconduct at the university. They were accused of billing or taking time and being paid for time and hours they did not work. This formed the basis of a termination proceedings that were started by the university. At the same time, within approximately the same month, the Nevada Attorney General's Office filed criminal charges against them, a gross misdemeanor under Nevada law, asserting the same violations, the same essential allegations. In November of 2002, my clients and I, with my assistance, we challenged the termination only before a Nevada personnel hearing. At that hearing, the hearing officer had limited apparent authority to only rule and decide and here take evidence on the issue of the termination, not the issues associated with the lawsuit that I had filed in May of 2002. He had no authority to address any of my federal claims or any of the state law claims. He was only there to review whether the termination by the university was appropriate or not.
I thought in the course of doing that, he had to make factual findings on whether there were falsehoods in the time sheets, et cetera.
He did. He did, certainly took evidence. There was testimony.
He made findings on that?
He made findings on it, but as I put forth my brief.
We're not talking about res judicata. We're talking about
issue preclusion.
Issue preclusion.
He did make findings on that. If I could jump in, I'll try and work back to that. In 2004, the criminal trial finally did go to trial, September 2004. I represented Mason and Diaz at that trial. It lasted 2 weeks, and at that hearing, which was fully and fairly litigated, where a number of existing and former officers of UNLV testified, including Chief David Hollenbeck, who instituted this entire policy back in the early 80s about using flex time that you heard, the jury of 12 Nevada citizens found them not guilty. I submitted to the court.
I was curious about it because that's the briefs ended just before the trial. But
yes.
It doesn't seem to have much to do with this case because it's a different standard on whether your clients were guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. That's one thing. Secondly, it doesn't set aside the fact that the administrative determination in the state court. And it seems that the law is that administrative determination is binding. Now, if it is binding, if it is, does preclude us on that issue, what's left of your case? Isn't it all dependent on a disagreement with what the administrative finding is?
The way Judge Pro ruled and what you're asking is whether issue preclusion, the elements of it as set forth in Clements, require that the prior hearing, whether administrative or state hearing, had whether the claimants had a right to fully and fairly litigate their claims.
All right. So your argument is essentially that there's no issue preclusion because it wasn't a fair and full hearing.
That's correct.
That's the argument on which you win or lose that issue.
Well,
the issue other than the individuals.
Well, under Clements, there seems to be some language as well that looking at the net effect of issue preclusion, there's language from the case that cites that whether the issue preclusion has some sort of prejudicial effect or impacts. Clearly, in this case, the impact of Judge Pro's decision for issue preclusion has effectively deprived my clients of a remedy.
Well,
they're factually innocent of the charge.
Say issue preclusion only counts when it doesn't make any difference. The whole point of issue preclusion is that, of course it's going to be helpful or harmful to one side or the other.
The reason the hearing in November 2002 was not a full and complete hearing.
Okay, now that's a different thing. If we're going to talk about whether it's a fair hearing, that issue I understand. But that is your issue, that this was not, there's no issue preclusion because this was not a full and fair hearing.
Correct. It comes down to that determination, whether we had the opportunity for a full and fair hearing. That's our argument.
And why do you say you didn't?
At the time the hearing was conducted in November 2002, we did not have David Hollenbeck available. David Hollenbeck was the former chief of police.
Trial unfair because a witness isn't available?
Well,
suppose this were a trial in district court, or suppose it had been the criminal trial. Could you come in afterwards and say that trial wasn't fair because Well, the witness wasn't available?
The criminal trial was different because we were able to fully and fairly litigate it. We were able to bring in the officers.
I'm saying, is it an argument that a trial is not fair because one side or the other doesn't have a witness available?
The hearing officer repeatedly throughout that hearing in November 5th of 2002 tried to curtail the nature and quality and type of evidence that we could present. He did not want us to present evidence prior to January 2001, but that was at the very core of our defense.
Now, that's a different point from saying a witness wasn't available.
Well, I mean, Hollenbeck was not available for the hearing, and we also had other officers as well we wanted to bring in to give testimony about what the prior practice was, because it was that prior practice that my clients were implementing that they were being accused of misconduct. It's a practice which still goes on at UNLV today.
Did that evidence come in the criminal trial?
Yes, it did. It was very persuasive evidence at the criminal trials. I paraded a whole stream of existing and former officers up there to talk about the use of flex time.
So is your argument then that it wasn't a fair hearing because the administrative officer excluded evidence that was critical?
Yes, and because he tried to curtail us, and I actually quoted in my brief from getting into the prior practices of the department, which are core to my client's defenses as to what they were doing with this use of flex time. So that is part of the argument. Judge Pro's decision as well looked at the issue of qualified immunity. Certainly it bears the discussion.
Okay. Before we get to qualified immunity, so you say you didn't have a fair hearing because it was limited to events in time improperly.
Yes.
And that your critical evidence related to a period before the time that the administrative officer considered relevant.
That's correct.
What did Judge Pro say about that?
Judge Pro essentially adopted the findings of the hearing officer. He said there was conclusive evidence of wrongdoing. Of course, this is before the criminal trial. He essentially adopted those findings and almost verbatim in his order as to how the hearing officer ruled. I mean, certainly Judge Pro in the district court was adopting those findings and ruling against us on issue preclusion. And he felt that we had a full and fair hearing and that we presented all our evidence. And, of course, you know, in my opposition to the motion for summary judgment, I did attach the we were able to then get the deposition of David Hollenbeck, who did testify about the use of flex time and how he implemented the program back in the late 1980s, the same practice that my clients were using when they were charged misconduct in 02.
I thought there was some notion that, as you said, at the criminal trial you had many witnesses on the
yes.
same point. And I thought one of the Judge Pro felt that you didn't bring those witnesses. It wasn't just Hollenbeck, but you could have brought other people if this was an important issue.
That's true. The judge did rule in that fashion. At the hearing in November 2002, there were approximately two or three other existing or former officers that I wanted to bring in. Mind you, I will tell you that when we did the hearing in 2002, it was very limited in the scope. We were not addressing, at least in my mind, I didn't believe the hearing officer had any apparent authority to address any of our federal claims or our state law claims, only the issue of the termination itself.
Okay. But Judge Pro felt that you weren't prohibited from bringing in those people. You simply didn't do it.
That's his contention. Of course, Hollenbeck was not available, and I've argued that, and he was not available, and I did not get his deposition until 2 months after the hearing in November of 2002.
Well, why wasn't he available?
Scheduling, I found that he was traveling back and forth to Indiana a lot. Took us quite some time to get his testimony down.
Did you ask for a continuance?
No, sir. We did not ask for a continuance. You want me to address the immunity issue before?
Sure. Yes.
Well, briefly, Judge Pro had ruled as well that qualified immunity protects Alike and Murray individually. It's my contention that both of my clients had federally recognized rights that both these officers knew of or should have known of, essentially a property interest in their job, and that by terminating them, they acted in derogation of those property interests. They are government employees, and they are entitled to certain protections. The due process interest is twofold, both procedural and substantive. Essentially, this is one of those cases I would argue that we're looking at a substantive due process violation of arbitrary and capricious conduct by both Alike and Murray. Alike was the chief of police in 2002, and Murray was his deputy chief. These individuals knew or should have known that what Sergeant Diaz and Officer Mason were doing was an existing longstanding practice in the department, and yet they still used this false allegation to justify a termination, to rid themselves of them from the department. That, I believe, is the due process violation which they acted in derogation of, and qualified immunity does not protect them or shield them from that exposure. I've saved the balance of my 5 seconds for any rebuttal unless you have any questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Richard Lindstrom, general counsel at UNLV and counsel for defendants in this matter. Notwithstanding the argument today, in essence, what they're saying is that the civil rights claims were not the subject of the hearing, and therefore it wasn't full and fair. In essence, then, compounding and confusing res judicata with collateral estoppel, because the district court's ruling was that the material facts, not only the relevant facts, but the material facts concerning the discharge were found at the administrative hearing. That having been done, then the federal claims all collapsed, notwithstanding the fact that they weren't addressed at the administrative hearing and shouldn't have been. That factual determination, which should be given preclusive effect, and I don't think they argue that.
What do you make, if I could interrupt, what do you make of the fact that a different standard of proof was applied at the administrative level? I mean, I gather that you would argue that we could not give the result of the criminal trial preclusive effect because a different standard of evidence applied, but the administrative tribunal did not apply a preponderance of evidence standard, which would have been normally applied in, if this case had been litigated in the first instance.
Well, I think there's settled authority that the federal courts must give the same preclusive effect that the state courts would give. There's settled Nevada authority that regardless of the standard used, the administrative hearings, if they're full and fair and the matters are actually litigated, will be given preclusive effect.
Well, the administrative law judge or the hearings officer took great pains to say that in reviewing the actions taken of the employer, it's the duty to determine if there's substantial evidence and to ensure the employer did not act arbitrarily or capriciously. Goes on to say substantial evidence has been defined as evidence which a reasonable mind might accept as adequate to conclusion. And goes on to say preponderance of the evidence to support an administrative decision is not equated with the preponderance of evidence, as there may be cases where two conflicting views may be each supported by substantial evidence. So it's an entirely different standard of evidence that the hearings officer was applying.
That's true.
It's a very deferential standard.
That's true, and the Nevada courts could have said, because it's a lower standard applied, we will not give preclusive effect to findings in the administrative arena. However, it's very clear that Nevada law does allow, if there's due process and full hearing, a fair hearing, that preclusive effect will be given. And obviously the difference in standards has always been there. So it's not a question that the Nevada Supreme Court said had some misapprehension as to the standard. So what you're saying is correct, and I guess there could be a rule that was different, but there isn't. That as it stands, it doesn't really, I don't say that it doesn't matter, but it's a matter of settled authority that it doesn't matter that it's a different standard.
I suppose that makes some kind of sense if they actually have a choice as to how they pursue this. But do they really have a choice?
Well, surely. They could have foregone, and in fact, interestingly enough, they did forego the first step. They didn't have their pre-deprivation procedures. They waived that, went straight to the State Personnel Board hearing. They could have actually not done the State Personnel Board. They could have filed the instant action right off the bat. There's no exhaustion type requirement before bringing their action in district court. So really, I think the scheme is set up to be beneficial to employees to get a relatively quick adjudication in the administrative arena. It's a practical matter. It tends to favor employees in that administrative arena to
How about his argument that it wasn't a full hearing because evidence was excluded?
Well, it's the nature of any fact-finding procedure that the adjudicator will make calls as to materiality and to relevance. And I think in this case, the hearing officer found that the evidence about what Hollenbeck did in the past was, I think he said, marginally relevant. And I think Judge Pro then found basically it wasn't a material fact. And I think the reason for that is kind of obvious. And that is there was really no contesting the fact that there had been flex time in the past. The factual question at the hearing was, didn't the new chief, Alike, change that? Didn't he issue a memo saying that? Wasn't that memo on the cover of the logbook, and didn't you see that? And those issues were litigated heavily at the administrative hearing, and a factual determination was made that, in essence, these employees didn't take into account the change in the rules and went ahead and conducted their behavior as they did in the past. Now, maybe to a jury, that obviated their criminal intent. I don't know what happened in the criminal case, and I think the point is it doesn't really matter for purposes of this proceeding. But I can see how you would tell a jury that over and over and over again to try to get a different result in a criminal case.
Well, this is a bit unusual, perhaps not unusual, but it's a bit unusual in that the plaintiffs apparently took a dual-track approach. They filed in state court, and then they also pursued their administrative appeals. But you removed this to federal court. I suppose the normal course of events would have been the state court would have stayed its decision, and the appeal would have gone up to the same district court and been consolidated. But they really didn't have that opportunity, did they, here?
That there's a normal course that it would be stayed. I mean, I think the normal course is it would have gone exactly the same way, only it would have been in state court instead of federal mm-hmm. court.
Well, part of the point you made, I think, in your brief was that they didn't appeal this decision.
They didn't appeal the administrative
right.
decision. Right. Which the import of that is, though, that it puts it in the category of cases that are subject to review. I mean, I think part of the Nevada Supreme Court's ruling in the past that these administrative determinations will be given preclusive effect was that they're subject to judicial review in a court of general jurisdiction. Now, that doesn't force, of course, a plaintiff or a disappointed party, either one, to go to district court, and they elected not to do that.
The odd thing, I think, here is if they had done that, if you had not removed the case, then in the ordinary course, that appeal would have probably been consolidated. Not necessarily, but could have been consolidated with this case. But this case would not have been subject to removal had they appealed the decision.
Well, no, they would have. They don't appeal the decision. They take a judicial review of the decision.
Yeah, exactly, judicial review. You would not have been able to review if they filed a petition for judicial review of the administrative decision. That's not something that would have been subject to removal.
No, but I don't think it would have been necessarily subject to consolidation either in mm-hmm. state courts. I mean, number one, I've never seen that happen. Number two, I don't know that the consolidation would be granted in a case like that because you're on totally different. Procedural grounds and legal grounds and everything else. So I think the assumption that they would have been consolidated in the state courts may not
be. In different cases, that would be – in different states, that would be the normal course. I can't speak to Nevada.
Let me go back to a question Judge Thomas asked you about the what the hearing officer actually decided. The ultimate decision is based on the findings of fact and conclusions of law. It's hereby adjudged and decreed that substantial, reliable, and probative evidence establishes that the action of the employer in dismissing the employees has been for the good of the public service, and the action is affirmed. Is that the binding conclusion that there's reliable, substantial, and probative evidence, or is it the findings of fact earlier?
I think it's the findings of fact, because the federal district court ruling is that the material facts supporting the claims were decided. So I think the material facts are contained in the findings of fact as opposed to the conclusions of law.
Well, this is the ultimate finding in the case. That there's substantial evidence. So that's the ultimate decision.
Correct. But, I mean, I think the problem is that's a finding of law that goes more to the claim. I mean, if we were saying it had claim preclusive effect, then I think we'd be looking at that. But if we're looking at the issue preclusion, the issue that starts the whole thing, in effect, is basically that the employees stole time, I mean, to put it colloquially.
Right, but that was based on the substantial evidence standard rather than preponderance standard.
Absolutely.
Right, okay.
If you read the ultimate decision into the findings of fact, you would read there's substantial evidence that they did this.
That's true, but if we're talking about the legal standard, he was There's no doubt that he applied the administrative standard. I mean, when you retake it as a whole.
But would you read that into the finding, the finding being there's substantial evidence that they engaged in this conduct? And but you say that that, under State law, has a preclusive effect on the issue of whether they actually did engage in the conduct.
True. But, I mean, I think that I just don't think that the Nevada law giving the preclusive effect centered on the standard applied. I mean, I just don't think it took it into account, as I recall the case.
Question on qualified immunity. It's very, one of the two statutes at issue requires notification. It's very difficult for me to see what's unclear about that statute.
Well, I think what it requires notification before the agency.
That's right.
Initiates procedures. In this case, the university was a victim of a crime, makes a criminal referral, which is the same thing as a criminal report, to the Attorney General's office. The State Attorney General is conducting a criminal investigation, at which time the university has no notion of when questions are going to be asked, what questions are being asked, or even what crimes or who's being investigated. For all the university would have known at that time, they could have been looking at the lieutenant involved above these defendants, the assistant chief, or the chief, for that matter. Because the victim of, once you turn it over to a prosecuting agency, you're not in control of that investigation. You don't, it simply is out of the university's hands completely. And such that as soon as the university got the report back from the AG that said, we find a crime was committed, we're going to file the charges, then the university took action, provided under our police officer's Bill of Rights the chance for them to have notice and a chance to be heard, which is that pre-deprivation due process right that they have to have in order for the termination to be valid to go forward. Now, they, I think it's uncontested that they waived that, declined to have that, and went straight to the personnel board proceeding.
Okay.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
When the university made the allegation or discovered that there's potential of this misconduct, they did conduct their own in-house investigation in September of 2001 that lasted approximately 2 to 3 weeks before they referred it to the Nevada Attorney General's office. I think it's important. There are exhibits within the record, memos from September 11th, 01, I think September 18th of 01, which document the fact that they did conduct an investigation. They did not notify my clients that this investigation was conducted.
That's the state statute that says they have to notify your clients. Is there a due process right to that?
I think, well, that implicates, I think, certainly a procedural due process right as well. If
in the absence of a state statute, would there be a federal right to notification before there's an investigation?
A federal right to notification? No. No. No, I wouldn't say there was.
You said the state statute creates a due process, federal due process.
It does, but there's also what I believe a substantive due process claim in light of the fact that these allegations were false, and they knew this or should have known that at the time they conducted their own in-house investigation.
Did they interrogate them?
They did not interrogate them. They did not formally notify them they were even looking at them.
All right.
If there are any other questions, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, sir.
Case just argued will be submitted.